The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day one of this July 2017, 5-day session here at Hidden Valley Zen Center in Southern California. On a hot but not so extraordinarily hot day. It is, after all, summer. And I want to speak to something that's probably on a lot of people's minds these days. Certainly, if you look at Facebook, it's all over the place. And I know a lot of people that are concerned about things. The broader thing is that the American culture seems to be deteriorating in pretty major and negative ways. It doesn't matter what side of the line you're on in terms of politics, both sides are expressing a certain amount of dysfunction, in some cases a great deal of dysfunction. Language these days, public language, is far more abrasive, aggressive, and negative than it used to be. It's quite a world we're creating these days, and it's not a really terrific place for our younger people to have to deal with, to grow into. I think of my two great-grandchildren here, currently 5 years old and 4 years old, and what the culture is going to be by the time they grow up into adulthood. And there's so much violence rampant these days as well. Just recently there was a headline where a young woman, 18 years old, just graduated from high school, was at a shopping mall with her mom and her grandmom buying clothes for college. And she went onto the freeway and some 28-year-old didn't like the way she was trying to merge, pulled out a gun and shot her dead. And attending the high school graduation of my granddaughter a couple of weeks ago, some of you already know, the ceremony was paused in the middle. A lot of the graduates had gone up and received their diplomas. There was still a long line of those waiting. And the videographer went over to the bleachers where we were all sitting. It was actually a rather great big auditorium. And focused in on a couple, an older couple, where the person who was presenting the diplomas presented them with a full-size photograph, well, not full-size, portrait, a large portrait of a beautiful young girl and her diploma. She should have been up there walking onto the stage and receiving it in person herself, but 2 weeks earlier, her boyfriend had shot and killed her. I don't know what the full story is, but it's so easy for people to pull out a gun and solve what they think is their problem by wiping out the other person. This is not something that used to happen generations ago, and it's happening more and more now. Possibly some of it, well, actually the social scientists are thinking that a lot of it comes because people spend so much of their time with their faces in the computer, interacting electronically with people and not in person with people. And so they don't pick up the normal kinds of cues, body language and so on, that we pick up ordinarily if we're face to face with somebody. And they don't learn how to mediate challenges, arguments in healthy ways. All they have to do is shut down the computer or type in some expletive and be done with it. And it's creating a series of generations of people who are well on their way to becoming sociopathic. But to see such negative, aggressive language publicly displayed at the top levels of our government by people who ordinarily should be quite decent and exemplary with each other, no matter what their differences of opinion. After all, there are elected representatives, and theoretically we elect people who are of utmost stature to represent us. So, this is what we're facing these days. Here in this Zendo, we have a phenomenal set of tools to work with this, both inwardly and outwardly. As we do our practice, focusing on the extended out-breath, being totally present in our bodies, it brings us increasingly closer to a clarity, a compassion and wisdom that is innate in us and helps us let go of the conditioning that would have us reacting rather than responding to circumstances. The tricky part is we have to practice it all the time. Well, not all the time, but we have to practice it a significant amount of time. We have to do the Zazen for a committed period of time each day. It can start out just being 25 minutes, but as it goes deeper, we'll want to expand it. We'll want to come to the center here to practice with other people who are practicing, because the when we practice together, it's synergistic. There's a common analogy to people practicing together in the Zendo, and that is that of the V-shaped formation of the Canada geese as they fly north and south. As these geese are flying, and they will fly 150 miles without coming down. And the young ones, the old ones, the weak ones would never be able to do this on their own. The leader of the V shifts and changes periodically so that not one bird is having to pull the whole train along. And there's something about the wave action created by the flapping of their wings in that formation that helps support the whole formation, so that they're all working to help each other fly longer. Our analogy is, in the terms of the Zendo, as we gather and do Zazen together, we're supporting each other, we're helping each other to go deeper. We're helping each other to let go more of our conditioning, more of our as a good friend of mine says, stuck places, so that we can move more seamlessly through the world. And as I said, respond rather than react to situations. As we do our practice and are able to little by little go deeper, and let me say this, and unless you're extremely advanced in your practice, you will not be able to discern, except in rare situations, whether you've gone deeper or not. Because it might seem like the practice is making you worse. It's not. It's only that it's making you clearer, so you're seeing more clearly where you are caught. And that gives you the incredible opportunity to be able to work with that caught place so that you can let it go. What I'm describing here is something called the long maturation, which is a vital part of Zen practice. The great Zen master Hakuin, Hakuin Ekaku, who lived in Japan. He was born in the 1600s, 1683, I think, died in the late 1700s, and is felt to have single-handedly revitalized Rinzai Zen in Japan. Any religion goes through ups and downs, and Zen is no exception to that. And it had reached a pretty low point when he was born. People got into Zen, they became monks for power. At one point in time, and I don't recall whether it was exactly during his lifetime or at a different point in time, every single member of the Japanese ruling body was a monk or priest, I guess we would call them more likely, in quite fancy robes, and they had gone into it simply for the glory of running around in a fancy robe and having a name. Real Zen people don't do that. There's a humility that develops as we do our practice, particularly as we open to where we're caught and we realize not only are we caught there and didn't realize it and acted out of it, but that means other people are caught too. And so we're not so judgmental. We realize that other people may have stuck places too that they're blind to. And this is also an important part of Zen practice. Perhaps a fundamental way to say it is that it's about honoring. It's about honoring ourselves. It's about honoring others. And it's hard to honor ourselves until we can accept ourselves. And the Zen practice helps us do this if we can't do it already. And to be honest, most people, most Westerners anyway, given the child-raising methods, are not able to truly honor themselves. We've been taught so much what's wrong with us that it's hard to believe that there is anything right with us. So Hakuin trained deeply. He also had to learn the hard way how to do effective Zen training, because he was party to the typical Japanese attitude of bullying through everything regardless. And there's an expression, ganbaru, which means to hang in there. Only it's a little bit more than what we say when we're hanging in there. And there actually is a Japanese term for early death through overwork. Zen teaches the middle way. And hanging there, in there up to a certain point, being willing to go through difficulty, not giving up at the first sign of it, not giving up at the first bit of knees hurting or back hurting or boredom or any of the kinds of things that come through our practice, but also knowing when it's time to take a break, take a nap, go to bed, go walk in the woods, have a nice cool drink of lemonade or something. Do something creative. He didn't realize that, and he just drove himself relentlessly to the point where he became quite ill. And he has written about how he cured himself. There's big questions about his story, not that he cured himself, because clearly he did. But he spoke of having met a hermit called Hakuyu up in the mountains outside of Kyoto, I believe. And there actually was a man named Hakuin, named Hakuyu, who did live as a hermit up in the mountains outside of Kyoto. However, he lived 300 years before Hakuin did. And Hakuin seems to covered that discrepancy by saying that when he met Hakuyu, he was 300 years old. Well, who knows? It's most likely that Hakuin came upon this way of working, which meant to, in the Eastern way of seeing it, bring his energy down instead of being up more and more and more and more tense in his upper body, trying to practice out of his head instead of his body, that he eventually was able to cure himself, and he wrote in detail about how he did it. And there is still a series of exercises that he had come up with, and it's now called Nikon therapy. It involves progressive relaxation through imagery, down, 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 bring your energy down. As a result of this, Hakuin emphasized the essential requirement of practice of focusing from your hara. That's your belly, your tanden. If you do martial arts, you know where that is. When we live from our tanden, we're more grounded, more balanced, more able to move in terms of martial arts in ways to avoid attack and so on and so forth. But it also bodes well for us in Zazen. And so always the instruction in Zazen is to relax the body, not flop, but to be upright, but shoulders are relaxed. And to do the breath properly, you want your belly to be relaxed also. And you breathe out naturally. And then what you ordinarily would start to breathe back in again, instead, you push it a little further out. And this is the gift. In order to do that, you have to focus on the experience of doing that. You can't multitask and do it. It's not susokkan if you do that. You focus in on your body, you experience the energy of your body as you're breathing out. It's 100% physical exercise. And as you push it further out, two things happen. You both focus more narrowly and your awareness expands. And you do it over and over again. Things will come up, frustration maybe, resistance, boredom. All kinds of things can come up, including a great deal of pleasure, which actually is more dangerous than the others. And you open to the experience of them and practice what's known as radical acceptance. This means you're not judging it. You're saying to yourself, in a sense, okay, this is what it looks like. And you don't try to fight it. You don't try to escape it. You open your arms and embrace it. But you don't get caught in it. You leave all the stories out of it. And this is also a vital aspect of practice. Not to get caught in the stories, because the stories drive us through an artificial way of living that is not true to ourselves. Who we are is not a set of stories. Who we are is an unfolding flow of response. And when we can be that aware and that attentive, life is joyful. And of course, all along, there's a lot of work to do. We begin little by little, as we do our practice more and more deeply, to become aware of where we're acting in less than harmonious, less than compassionate, less than wise ways. And there's a corresponding remorse and regret that comes up when we see that, if we are willing to open ourselves to that. And when we do open ourselves to that, it goes a long way to defusing that habit pattern of dysfunction. This is what's known as the long maturation. Tore Inji was probably Hawking's most important Dharma successor. And he was quite young. He came to Hakuin, already a monk and already having practiced. By the time he was 26, he had had such a deep awakening experience and had such deep understanding and commitment to practice in what we call 360-degree practice. Practice in every area of our life. That doesn't mean you do zazen all the, you know, every minute of the day. It means that you do zazen, and then as you go about your daily life, the awareness that you develop through the zazen, the mindfulness, you keep in place that part of it. And you allow yourself to be as aware as possible in each moment so that you do tune in to your motives, your whatever's going on. And it's not about stories, again, because stories cannot touch reality. Stories ride above it. And when we live in stories, we're like a stone skipping across water. When we skip a stone across the water, it hits the water every once in a long while, but a lot of the times it's up in the air. And that's how our life is, and our life is not very fulfilling that way. We may wonder why it's not fulfilling. Well, it's because we're not really living it. Tore Inji also got quite ill, and there's a couple of different possibilities. One is that he was striving like Hakuin had and had done the same thing. Another more recent theory is that he actually had TB. At any rate, the doctors gave up on him, and he decided that if he was going to die, what he wanted to do was to write down everything he understood about Zen practice. And he wrote a wonderful treatise that you can get a copy of. It's been translated by one of the Cleary brothers, and it's for sale on Amazon.com. I thought we had a copy here, but I think it wandered elsewhere, unfortunately. And so I can't really show you the book. But it's remarkable in its expression of true Zen practice. He covers the whole nine yards. He talks about the ancestry. He talks about the essential need for practice in general. He talks about the further need for what he calls the advanced practices, which is when you have already passed a breakthrough koan, and then you work through a long series of subsequent koans that will hone and deepen your initial breakthrough. And hopefully you will have many more breakthroughs as a result of that continuing practice. But all along the way, and this can start before you even do your first out-breath, is what he calls the importance of the long maturation, and that is what I've just been speaking of, to integrate the clarity of mind, the insight, the wisdom and the compassion that begin to flow forth from our zazen into our daily life. And that includes becoming aware of those stuck places, tuning in, feeling the remorse, and letting them go. When we do that process, when we see a place where we have been dysfunctional, and at that point, normally remorse and regret comes up. And it's strong and deep, and if we feel it as energy in our body, There's something that happens then. It's like we make a commitment. We develop an intention never to do that again. And the next time the old habits would start to come up and we would move in the direction of doing it again, something comes up first and says, wait a minute, do you really want to go there? And it's easy not to. But this doesn't happen without a lot of hard work. And this is the long maturation. This is the 360-degree practice to do our Zazen, which forms the basis. This is the tool that we were able to use to clarify our mind, to come to a kensho, which literally means seeing into, which means seeing into the nature of reality, the true nature of reality, and then to work to expand and deepen that awareness and hopefully, as I said, undergo more insights, more kensho, more satori, until we are so cleared out that our life has changed remarkably. And then it will not matter what our outward life circumstances are. We will still be able to live in a mind state of innate freedom. Hakuin's grandfather in Zen was a man who was a monk in the early 1600s in a village in Japan, a small village. And this was an era way before the Meiji Restoration where Buddhist monks and clergy were made into ordinary people in terms of the government. In other words, they were not clergy. They were just regular citizens, which is why they could be sent off to war in the Second World War. It was way before that. And in his day, monks were celibate. And this was a real serious thing. And he was in his 40s when this happened, living in a little temple in this little village. And if you know anything about the Japanese culture, there's a great emphasis on not rocking the communal boat, basically. And as it turns out, a young girl in the village, unmarried, got pregnant. And her parents kept trying to ask her who the dad was, and she kept refusing, and finally she burst out as that monk. And so when the baby was born, the grandparents marched it over to the monk and presented him with this infant with a great deal of anger, and they felt it was justified under the circumstances, and said, here, he's yours, you deal with it. And the response of the monk was simply to humbly say, oh, I see, it looks like that, doesn't it? He received the baby, he raised it for a year. After the year, the mother confessed who the father really was. And now the grandparents are really embarrassed because now they've besmirched the name of this man unnecessarily. And it made his life quite difficult, by the way, during that year, because the village scorned him. It was very hard to find anything to eat. In those days, monks begged for their food. Beggy is not the right word, but we won't get into that at this point. And on bended knees, with a great deal of embarrassment, asked for the baby back. And again, all he said was, Soka, I see. Looks like that, doesn't it? This is this radical acceptance. No doubt he could understand deeply and felt deeply the embarrassment of the grandparents in the second situation and the ire of the grandparents in the first. But he was so free, so let go, so deeply awake that it didn't grab him. And he was able to respond instead of react. And the reason we know this story, because it's a true story, is because the village was so impressed by his behavior that they passed it down to this time. And we can learn about it now. This is the level of freedom that you can have. He didn't feel insulted. He didn't feel attacked. He understood what was going on. The girl had lied. It was useless to say, well, you know, I don't do things like that. Or when they came to take the baby back, we could have figured out that I wouldn't have done that. He had no need to react. No need to even feel like, sheesh, they should have known. None of that. I'm sure that what came forth for them was compassion for the grandparents, because they were dealing with this extremely embarrassing situation. In our day and age, it wouldn't be embarrassing at all. But it certainly was extremely embarrassing in its era in Japan. And it would be embarrassing in Japan now too. Our practice brings us back into touch with an inner kind of gyroscope we have, because we are fundamentally perfect. But conditioning has led us to believe otherwise. And through our pain, sometimes deep suffering, it's led us to react in ways that don't express that innate perfection. Nonetheless, that innate perfection is there. And through our Zazen, we can open to it. And as we open to it, it influences not only our own lives, but also the lives of countless other beings. I gave an example of this in the opening talk last night of the man who was incarcerated in Buchenwald, the older guy who was a welder, Frenchman. In those days, the Nazis felt that anyone past a certain age didn't deserve to live. And so they rounded up a lot of people who were older, as well as people who were did not fit the image of perfection that the Nazis held. And he had such a demeanor of openness, of honoring, of clarity, that people followed him around all over the camp, hanging on to the energy of that openness, that honoring, that clarity. And while we might not have people following us around, nonetheless, it's felt. And our interactions with people will be very different as a result of that. In order for that to happen, though, we really have to do the work. We really have to sit on a regular basis. We really have to be willing to face whatever comes up and embrace it, feel it, because that's how it's let go. That's how it's moved on from. And little by little, we open to that innate perfection. And little by little, as we do that, our life is filled more and more with joy, with ease, with harmony, no matter what our circumstances are. This is why Zen practice has endured for almost 3,000 years. I've been going on for a while here. Thank you for listening. And we'll now recite the four vows.